Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 13th, 2007. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. But this week, we've talked about growing our own hops for beer in the past. Why not keep our own bees and harvest our own honey for our meads and braggots? This week, we talked to hobbyist beekeeper Ryan Wilson, who can give us some insight into his newfound hobby. Ryan takes it a step further by keeping things organic. Well, if you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. Well, last week's episode on marketing the idea of drinking homebrew to our friends and family generated a bunch of response. For those who weren't with us, we talked to creative marketers Bob Korsgaden and James Gardner of JimBobCreative.com about how we can compete with the big boys, so to speak, for tasting time with our buddies, or at least get our foot in the door. It seems a lot of us are in the same boat in convincing others to take this step into enjoying better beer. Well, let's take a look into the mailbag and see what you guys had to say about the topic. Bruce from Edmond, Oklahoma writes, I served a keg of pale ale at a poker game I hosted. Just as Bob and James said in the interview, sitting around a poker table was a great venue to enjoy the beer, and it provided enough time to talk about the brewing process. I've since had a couple of conversations with players who are interested in starting to homebrew, so I agree with your comments about selling homebrew being an evangelical tool. Presentation, Bruce says, as you talked about in this week's interview, is a lot of the fun of serving homebrew. My first time around, I made some fun labels, but like you, I soon found they were a pain to clean off for the next batch. I'm kegging now and avoiding bottles altogether. The corny keg in an ice chest with a picnic tap doesn't present the image I want, though, so the next upgrade is a mini fridge converted to a kegerator. My plan is to use a sheet protector on the kegerator door with an insert showing the current beer being served, an idea I'm sure Bob and James stole from me when they talked about putting labels on the front of the refrigerator. Well, there you go. Rob from Memphis, Tennessee, writes with a strategy to convert mega beer drinkers. Rob says one way is to challenge them to try something different. I would offer them one of their favorites to replace the homebrew or our micro if they just give it a chance. I don't cloud the tasting with style names or ingredient information. Just tell them that it's going to have more flavor than what they're used to. Most of my friends and family have been very receptive and keep coming back to try some of my other varieties. I even convinced my brother, or converted my brother, rather, into an IPA fan. His only complaint now is that he can't go back to his old favorite, Bud Ice. One less for the big guys. I appreciate that, Rob. Do they still make Bud Ice? I guess they do. Gavin in Prairie Village, Kansas, weighs in with this. I think that your marketers missed a key tactic in getting friends and family to appreciate homebrew. Homebrew has an unfortunate stigma attached to it, which we must all overcome with our friends. I suggest making a simple analogy with friends about how a home-cooked meal tastes much better than fast food. Many times, home-cooked food tastes better than even some mid-to-high-end restaurants. From there, the comparison is easy. BMC beers like Taco Bell, McDonald's, and KFC. They're all cheap, easy to find, and passable. Sure, Gavin says, there's a time and a place when they taste great and hit the spot, but it's not the food you would want to eat 100% of the time. Homebrew is that home-cooked meal that's made to order with all the care and love that goes along with it. Some craft beer, mainly thinking for double IPAs, American IPAs, barley wine, and some other challenging beers, is like the gourmet restaurants in town where the food is great, but they might have a menu with some unusual items. Those unusual items are great tasting, but might not be for everybody on their first visit. Good comparison there, Gavin. Thanks a lot. Jeff from Leesburg, Virginia, has a similar take. The way I market my homebrews to new people is that I use the analogy of food comparison. Store-bought beer is akin to a frozen dinner. If that's what you're used to, you can prefer it until you get a fine home-cooked meal. Then your eyes are open to the flavors. The biggest input that people respond to is that homemade wine struggles to be as good as a normal $10 to $20 store-bought wine, whereas a homemade beer is better than just about any store-bought beer, regardless of price. I think a lot of people compare the homemade wine quantity or quality and homemade beer quality, but there's really no comparison in the taste difference. Well, there I have to disagree with you, Jeff. Steve Wilkes and I made a Merlot and a Riesling earlier this year, and they turned out wonderfully. I think it's the quality of the kit that you get. There are some very, very, very good wine kits out there. I think you ought to give wine making another chance. It really does make some good. Of course, you can make some bad stuff too, but there are some really good kits out there that you can make some really good wine and save some money too. But that's another show. By the way, Jeff classifies the big boy beers as leg lifter lagers. So there you go. Thanks, Jeff. Jesse, from one of the homes of big beer, St. Louis, Missouri, writes, one way that I have sold friends and family on the current homebrew that I'm offering is to talk about the history of that particular style. For example, I had an American IPA that I was offering on tap at a party. To a couple people that I knew who were Bud Light drinkers, I talked about the history of the British voyages to India, hence IPA, and they were extra hopped and had high alcohol to make the long voyage. This immediately brought interest to the beer. What surely would have been a pucker face from the bitter taste became a look of interest and delight as they drank it. So Jesse's a kind of a beer historian as well as a proselytizer, I guess you'd say. Easy for me to say. Dan from San Luis Obispo, California, which is a beautiful area of the country, by the way, writes, you failed to mention one of the biggest obstacles that I've encountered to sharing homebrewed beer, misconceptions about homebrewing. I've talked to countless people who have this impression that homebrew is unsafe or somehow dangerous to drink. I've tried to explain that we use all the same methods that the big brewers used, and that I put a lot of effort into selecting quality ingredients and sanitizing, but people still have this idea in their heads that I'm brewing cheap malt liquor in my bathtub or something. Some people I've talked to even equate homebrewing with illegal distilling. Have you ever encountered these kinds of misconceptions? Well, Dan, in fact, not only have I encountered them, I've had them myself. When my buddy Andy first started brewing and talking about it at work, I have to admit that I made jokes about the revenuer coming after him with a shotgun and asking Andy whether he had to put camouflage netting over his patio when he brewed to hide from the sheriff's department helicopters, and so on and so forth. So, you know, what goes around comes around. Now I'm answering similar questions myself. But I think the best defense against these misconceptions is to brew the best beer that you can and share it with those who are skeptical and convert them. Bill in East Greenwich, Rhode Island, found a way to get his friends get into his friends' hearts and pocketbooks as well. Bill says, for a few years, I'd had the desire to start homebrewing, but I never took the leap. Last year, I made the decision to start at the encouragement of some friends. I made a list of needed equipment and tallied up the cost. I didn't have the extra cash at the time, so I sold shares of my brewery to raise the startup money. For $24 each, seven of my friends provided me with the cash to buy equipment, and in return, they got a six-pack from each of my first four batches, and they got to vote on which beers I would brew. Bill says for the first batch, we had a get-together where everyone was involved in the process, and I got to explain some of the technical aspects I had learned. 3 weeks later, we had another get-together to bottle the brew. 3 weeks after that, we had a tasting party. It was a great excuse to have a gathering of friends every few weeks. Whenever a new batch was ready to drink, I'd pick up two commercial microbrews of the same style and have a blind taste test to see who could pick out my brew. Our gatherings were a great time, and everyone agreed that they got their money's worth. Well, that's great. It sounds like you've found a way around the legalities there. I'm not an attorney, Bill, or a law enforcement officer, but it sounds like to me that your friends weren't buying homebrew, they were buying investing in equipment. Very good. Thanks for everybody's feedback on the topic. Good luck. in spreading the word about good beer. Oh, and one more from Alexander up in Montreal, soon to be Austin, I think. Alexander says, for several reasons, I have a much better luck marketing coffee than beer. Coffee has different connotations from beer in mainstream U.S. culture, and cafes are different from pubs. But also it's easier to get someone to try home roasting in a popcorn popper, still my preferred method, or using a French press than it is to get them to homebrew. Not to mention that almost everyone likes the way coffee smells. Olfactory marketing is more efficient with coffee than with beer. So there you go. But keep at it, Alexander. One more letter before we jump into the interview. Lewis from Wisconsin heard our discussions about using dry ice to chill wort and to purge fermenters with CO2. Lewis writes, I work at a cheese plant, and our cultures arrive packed in dry ice. The usual way we dispose of this is to put it, 20 pounds or more, in a plastic 5-gallon bucket. I've noticed on many occasions, after the dry ice has sublimed completely, there is leftover dirt particles. I would never consider using dry ice directly in beer. If anyone would want to use it, I would suggest a wort chiller. Have one set of coils packed in dry ice, and then a second coil going through the wort. So there you go. Even dry ice might be dirty. Lewis recommends that you keep it out of your wort and or your fermenter. So there you go. Good to know. I appreciate the input. Now, let's go on to our main topic for today. I talked to Ryan Wilson of Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's a home brewer who's taken on another hobby that could be useful in our pursuit of fresh, flavorful fermentables. Keeping bees. Well, Ryan Wilson, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, thank you, James. I'm glad to be a part of this.
Well, you wrote me and volunteered to be a subject on the topic of beekeeping, and that is something that's, well, not necessarily beekeeping, but the product of beekeeping is close to our hearts as brewers, because I've used honey in beers and certainly used honey in meads, but don't know a whole lot about how we get the stuff in the first place. So maybe in the next few minutes we can learn enough to know more going into going into our own careers as beekeepers. How, give us a background on your brewing career and how you got into beekeeping.
Well, brewing started about probably like many home brewers about 5 years ago or so. My sister got me a kit, I guess, like one of those kits you get, and I think it had a kit of ingredients in there also, and it just kind of took off from there. I brewed maybe off and on, not real intensely, for about 5 years, and made a lot of extract batches and things like that. And this year sort of really took off. Moved into making all grain, and probably brewed, I don't know, about half a dozen all grain batches this year. So it's been really exciting.
Did you get into beekeeping because of your brewing?
No, I don't think so. Beekeeping, again, is just a hobby for me. Nothing real, you know, I just always sort of interested in it. And finally have a house where I'm not moving around, not in an apartment, and have something where I'm going to be here for a little while. So I thought I could set it up in my backyard.
Now, beekeeping is something that, you know, a lot of people are afraid of bees, and some people are allergic to bees. So I would imagine that does it take a certain temperament to be a good beekeeper?
I think you just have to be patient. And just not to be anxious around them. I have been stung a few times, and it's not, you know, anything to worry about. So, and another thing, too, is most people that are so-called allergic to bees probably haven't ever been stung by a honeybee. They've usually been stung by either yellow jackets or wasps or hornets or something like that. So honeybees do produce venom, and they do sting, but it's, and there can be some cross reactivity to that, but they're not, you know, just because you're allergic to a yellow jacket doesn't mean you're going to be allergic to a honeybee.
So bees may be getting a bad rap.
Yeah, definitely. And also they're not, you have to think of bees as more defensive, not aggressive. So they will sting to defend their hive, but they won't, you know, if you see them on a flower or something like that, they're not going to come at you and sting you. So even if you aggravate them a little bit, you know, which I don't recommend, but whereas a wasp or a hornet, something, they might come after you.
And you, when you tend your hive, you wear protection and you have something to sedate the bees while you're doing that, right?
Yes. I do wear a veil, I guess, which is sort of your stereotypical, I don't know, mask type thing that has a screen to keep the bees from getting in your face. I also wear gloves. And then I have a smoker, which will, you know, kind of calm the bees down a little bit. So, but honestly, I don't use the smoker a whole lot. I do use it to get them off of something that I, you know, I need to get to and get them away from that. But I don't, you know, just go ahead and smoke the whole hive and then go work on it. I try and do what I can without disturbing them too much. So,
so at an entry level, what is a basic beekeeping kit like?
Well, there's not really too much to it. I sort of wrote down a little list, but there's the smoker, there's a veil, and then there's the gloves. And then all I have in mind is a knife, a sharp knife, and then I have one of those flat crowbar-type thing priors and a screwdriver. And that's it. That's all I have. So that's the only equipment I have, and that's the only things that I use. So I have a bucket that I carry it out in, but that's about it. So.
But you've got to have the box itself. Do you have kind of a wooden box like we're used to seeing out next to fields and that need to be pollinated and such as that?
Right. I've actually built my own hive, and it's sort of, if you look at a cross section, it's sort of like looks like a trapezoid, I guess would be, with sort of the narrow end in the bottom and it's sort of wider on top. And then I use it's called a top bar hive. So the traditional style hive is sort of like a vertical boxes where they sort of add on more sections of the hive as the bees build more honey. But this is sort of a horizontal hive. So it's about 4 feet long, and it has about 30 bars on the inside of it. And the bees build their comb and hang down in sort of like a, like an oval shape from these individual bars. And then you can pick up the individual bars along with that associated comb. And then if you're harvesting the honey, you know, you would cut that off along with the honeycomb itself and then take that back and extract the honey from it.
Now, what's involved in extracting the honey? And first of all, I guess I should ask, when do you harvest the honey? Is it just one time of year?
Well, top bar hives need to be harvested a little more frequently than the traditional hives because they can fill up. Traditional hives, they sort of just keep stacking on empty comb, I guess, is the best way to describe it, and the bees will keep building up. But this is my first year, and so actually I harvested very little honey this year. And I want to make sure they can make it through the winter. So, and an average hive can take anywhere from 20 to 60 pounds of honey left in the hive to use as food supplies during the winter. So I didn't want to take any away this fall. I want to make sure they can make it through the winter. In the springtime, when the flowers and the trees and everything bloom, I can go in and take whatever I need or whatever is there because they will build up more through the summer.
Yeah, you're up there in Grand Rapids, Michigan, or near there, so your winters are a little harsher than we've got down here. So
yeah, they get below freezing and lots of snow, and it can be pretty hard.
So what's involved in harvesting the honey?
Well, with this style, because the bar or the combs are attached to the bars, so you basically lift up that bar, cut off the honeycomb, and then I use the crush and strain method, I guess is the best way to describe it. So I'll take that honeycomb, crush it all up, and just kind of break all the cells, and then I'll put it in a bucket or something like that and strain it through a muslin cloth or a cheesecloth or something like that, and then leaves all the wax, gets caught in the above it, and all the honey seeps through. It takes, it can take a while to do it, and I leave it in a sunny window or something like that to kind of speed up the process. So,
is this one aspect of the hobby that if you wanted to buy more toys or more tools, that this is where it would come into play?
Yeah, this is definitely. There's extractors can run, $400 on up. And they're centrifugal type things where you put the frames of honey in and you open them up and then you spin them around and all the honey sort of gets sucked to the end and then, drop down. But I have such a low, I just have one hive and it's no problem for me to do it this way. Commercial beekeepers or, beekeepers with more than five or so hives would probably benefit from having an extractor.
How much honey can you expect to get out of a hive the size of yours?
Oh, that's hard to say since I haven't done it yet. But each one of those bars probably, you might get maybe 5 to 8 pounds.
Mm.
And there's, like I said, there's 30 bars, but the first 10 to 12 are used for brood rearing, where they lay their eggs and the larvae and stuff like that. And then all the surplus honey is stored in the back. So, with a completely full hive, you might get, maybe 15 bars, 5 to 8 pounds each. So it's a significant amount.
It's a bit of mead.
Yeah, definitely. It completely varies, too, on how the flowers did that year, your location, what type of flowers, that type of thing. To get 1 pound of honey, the bees actually have to visit over 2 million flowers, and they have to travel about 55,000 miles just to collect 1 pound of honey.
Wow.
So that's something to keep in mind, when you're dumping all that honey into your fermenter. Think about that.
So when you think about it, all the work that the bees are doing to produce your honey is kind of like all the work that the yeast is doing to produce your beer and mead.
Exactly. I think the biggest thing is just to, keep them healthy and happy and provide them with the requirements they need to thrive and succeed, and they'll produce excellent honey for you.
It's another partnership between man and nature.
Exactly.
You talk about, going and finding the flowers and such as that. Do you have to be in a rural environment to have good honey?
Oh, no, not at all. There's actually, I just saw a show on Discovery Channel or something like that where they had beekeepers on the roofs of skyscrapers. And they are, how many hundreds of feet in the air, and there's plenty of trees and grasses and even backyard gardens or flower boxes or all those things. So there's plenty of flowers around for them to gather their honey.
Now, you'll get different flavors of honey depending on where your hive is, I would assume.
Yeah, that is. But there's, when we see the varietal honey for sale, those are, specifically, they'll put on, and right before that flower blooms, commercial beekeepers will add empty comb. And then as soon as that bloom is done, they will remove that so that they hope that whatever is in that area is predominantly whatever was the major bloom at that time.
Hmm.
So that's how you have, orange blossom honey or basswood honey or sourwood honey or those different varieties.
There are also commercial beekeepers that rent out their hives to produce farmers and such as that.
Oh, yeah. And, in fact, honeybees are responsible for about 80% of the food produced in the world. So they're, without the honeybees to pollinate the crops, we would be short about 80% of the food that we have in the world.
So honeybees have been in the news lately with there's been a news round or a news cycle of stories about honeybees disappearing or getting sick and dying. What have you heard about that, and has that impacted your hobby?
No, it hasn't impacted me at all. And I think they're still sort of searching for what causes all that. And I've heard various explanations. I think we talked earlier about the cell phone towers to pesticides to mite parasites on the bees, all kinds of different things. But some, I've heard stories of some commercial beekeepers with 200 hives, and all of a sudden, mysteriously, 150 of them are gone, or empty, or have been, all the bees are gone. And they can't figure out why or what's causing it. So,
is that something to worry about, or is this just a cyclical thing that it happens every now and then and the bees come back?
It's probably cyclical, and I don't think it's real cause for alarm now, but certainly without the honeybees to pollinate the crops, we'd be in trouble. But I think they'll probably come back and be just as healthy and happy as ever. So I'm not too worried. It hasn't affected me at all. So
now, you said in your email, and one of the things that interested me most in talking to you was you do something, a method that is different from the normal method, and the way you do it, it's considered organic.
Right. It's 100% organic. I don't use anything artificial, any artificial medications in my hive at all. Commercial beekeepers will often use 3 or 4 or more different medications throughout the year, treating for different types of diseases. There's foul brood, chalk brood, mites, Nosema, a whole bunch of different sort of things that can affect the way the honeybees infect their productivity or the health of the hive. So I just didn't want to have to mess with that. I didn't want to have to worry about that in the honey, because what they will do is they will treat, and then there's a certain period of time where they can't collect the honey, and then they'll be able to collect the honey after that time is up, and they'll try and collect some, and then they'll treat again for something else. So it's kind of a lot more management headache than just let the bees do what they want and be happy, and everybody will be better for it, I think.
So is there something in the method that you use that you don't have to do all that medication?
Yeah. Normal bees in the wild produce a cell size of about 4.9 millimeters across in diameter. And back, I don't know how long ago, but they thought about artificially increasing the size of the honeybee in order to make them larger and thought be able to carry more nectar and therefore produce more honey. So they sort of artificially increased the cell size of the honeycomb to about 5.4 millimeters, and that makes the bees larger. And a lot of commercial beekeepers will use sort of pre-stamped honeycomb, and the bees will draw out or build their own comb from that originally starting foundation. With the top bar method, it lets the bees build the comb the way they naturally want to, and actually after a few generations will sort of regress back to that natural 4.9 or 4.8 millimeter cell diameter. And the organic beekeepers that I've talked to, this has sort of eliminated the need to medicate your hives at all, just by allowing the bees to build this sort of natural cell size. And I think part of it is the larger bees will spend an extra day in the cell capped before they emerge as sort of adults. And there's some thought that the mites can take hold during this time and be, you know, more detrimental. There's an extra day where the mites can sort of affect the health of the bee. But by doing it, you know, naturally like this, the bees are sort of reverting back to how they've always been, and have evolved with the mites and these diseases for, you know, who knows how long, and are functioning just fine that way.
So, according to that theory, Mother Nature knows best.
Right, exactly. That's exactly. And I just, like I said, I just didn't want to have to hassle with putting medications on at a certain time and then not worrying about the honey and, you know, all this other stuff. So I just decided to go with it. And my bees are very, very healthy, and they filled up their whole hive this year, and I think they're going to be, you know, have a good chance at going through the winter and a good productive start in the spring.
Now, you mentioned larger bees. I grew up in the 70s, and back then we went through a fear phase about killer bees and how killer bees were coming up from South America and Central America, and they were coming into the United States to swarm us and kill us off. And uh, these These came from a crossbreeding with African strains of bees, which were more aggressive. Is that something that you have to worry about?
I think there was a study, I think, that based on bees in Argentina, I believe it was, that they could potentially inhabit this far north, but I don't think that any that has happened yet. I know it's more predominantly in the south. And the problem is they are, I guess, aggressive still isn't the right word, but they're overly defensive. For example, if I'm, you know, messing with a hive and the bees sort of are defending it, if I walk a few feet away, they're going to leave me alone. Whereas more Africanized bees will not leave you alone. They will continue to follow you and continue to sort of sting you or harass you, you know, even up to 400 yards away from what I hear. And so that's kind of they're not out to sting you if you're just walking around. They're not going to come out and randomly attack people. But if you're invading their hive or close to their space, that's when they become defensive and sort of overly defensive. And commercial beekeepers, if they have noticed in the south some of them being, you know, showing some more defensive traits. So they will actually go in, find the one single queen, kill her, and then requeen with a domestic or European queen, and that will calm the hive down and restore sort of normal bee behavior.
So the genetics, it's all genetics. If you put a normal queen in there, her genes are going to spread to the other bees, and then they'll chill out a little bit.
But the Africanized bees produce a ton of honey, though. I mean, they produce just a ton of honey.
And I think that was the reason that they wanted to crossbreed that strain in there to begin with, was that they were more productive. But here's a tip for you. I remember the movie about killer bees back in the 70s. At the end, they lured the swarm into the Superdome and turned on the air conditioner full blast and were able to chill the bees down to where they were dormant, and then they could take care of them. So there's a little hint for you, just in case.
If that ever happens, we'll know what to do.
Yeah. now you mentioned the queen. You have one queen in your hive, and is there kind of a routine of things that you need to do with the queen and with the hive throughout the year to keep the hive going and healthy?
Sure. It actually requires very little maintenance. Top bar hives require a little bit more attention at first. The main thing they need to do is make sure that comb that they're producing is straight across those bars and doesn't wave in any way, and also make sure that there's only one comb per bar. And because it's a law in all 50 states that a bee inspector has to come in or could come in and be able to remove individual frames of your beehive and examine them for signs of disease. So you see the traditional sign of the beekeeper symbol, the straw skep, which is sort of the circular-looking pyramid-type.
Oh, yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, those are illegal. You can't use those because you can't remove individual frames from the straw skep. So that is important. And in the springtime, since mine was a very new hive, and I started with basically a package of bees, and I had to feed them for about 3 weeks. And all that was is sort of equal amounts of sugar to water, and I sort of boil it up, and then I put it in a Ziploc bag, either a quart size or a gallon size, however much I was giving them, and then I make a few slits in the top of it and set it inside the hive, and they will just eat that until that the flowers start to bloom.
Now, what keeps the queen in there? What keeps her from finding another home in your eaves or something?
Well, that's actually, when that happens, that's actually how bees reproduce. It's called swarming, and it's a sign of a healthy hive, but it's also something as beekeepers who try and manage or prevent that from happening, because what happens is you have to look at the whole hive as one single organism, and in order to reproduce, they have to split off a part of that that goes finds another home. And so what will happen is the bees will, a couple of different things can trigger it, you know, overcrowding, you know, the hive is too full of bees and there's not enough room or all those other things. And so they will raise, you know, several new queens, and then the old queen will group off with anywhere from like 25 to 50 to 75% or whatever of the bees in that hive, and they'll go out and they'll land on a tree somewhere. And then they will send out scouts from that swarm, and that's where they end up in your eaves or, you know, in the attic or whatever. And then they'll go and establish a new home somewhere else. So that's how honeybees replicate, I guess is the best way to say it.
So how do you get on top of that? How do you keep from being a menace to your neighborhood with with wild hives everywhere?
Right. Well, most hives will I don't know, it's hard to say, but sometimes they'll swarm once a year. Some hives will swarm more often than that. But when they swarm later on in the year, there's not enough bees. They can be as small as a softball clump of bees to really establish themselves. So it's the bigger swarms you have to worry about. But as beekeepers, we sort of manage that by making sure there's plenty of room in the brood area. So what that means with a top bar hive is, okay, it's getting kind of crowded. Well, I'll spread that out. I'll make a gap, and then I'll put a new empty bar in the middle there, and that'll give the bees something else to focus on. So they'll build another comb, and then they'll start laying more eggs, and then they'll, you know, not feel so crowded or cramped.
So there's ways to control it.
Right, there is. And it's not ever foolproof or 100%, and there's a bunch of different ways out there. But and most of the time, they'll end up in a tree or, you know, a hollow tree or something like that. They'll be around.
And I've talked to a local beekeeper who has actually been called out to kind of box up and catch a wild hive. So, you know, that may be an opportunity for experienced beekeepers to, I guess, get more bees, too.
That's exactly what it is. And they will love the opportunity because it's like more bees, more honey, more, you know, so that's a good opportunity for them.
Everybody likes free stuff.
There are also steps that sort of like backyard beekeepers can do to minimize interference with their neighbors. Bees have a really interesting trait that they will fly in a straight line to get to where they're going. So, for example, if you live in a backyard and you have a sort of a 8-foot-high privacy fence around your yard, and you have a hive inside of that yard, the bees will fly until they hit that fence, go up to 8 feet, and then fly straight, and then go down to get to where they're going. So anybody in between that path would probably never ever see the bee or run into them in any way, shape, or form because they're above their heads. And so that's pretty interesting.
Huh. So if you put a barrier around the hive, maybe that would help.
Right, exactly. And also providing them a source of water. They seem to really gravitate towards swimming pools.
Oh.
So if your neighbors probably won't appreciate you if you have bees and they're trying to swim and there's bees all over the swimming pool. So I just put a 5-gallon bucket near my hive, and I keep some wood chips and things on the top of it so that the bees don't drown in the water. And that seems to keep them happy, give them a source of water, and everybody's happy.
So what's the price point? What's the entry point of becoming a beekeeper?
Well, I'm into this whole thing, not counting the bees, for $150 or less.
Wow.
And that's all the equipment, building my own hive, and that's it. And I really, you know, I don't see myself spending any more money on equipment. There just really isn't anything else that I need or want or could use to help me in any way. I've got a whole long list of brewing equipment that I could use, but there's no more bee equipment that I can use. And as it is right now, I go out there maybe once every 3 weeks or so, where I actually will open up the hive and inspect it and make sure everything's going okay. But every day I just go out and I look at it and watch all the bees coming and going, and it's really interesting.
So is there anything that you would, anything else that you would advise potential novice beekeepers out there as they're getting into it? Is there something that came up after you got into it that you didn't realize as you were getting in?
No, I would have started earlier and built my hives. I think I'd finished my hives about 1 week before, beans came. So I was kind of pressed for time there. But you should check with your local regulations. Some townships actually have a specific no bee ordinance. So that's something to be aware of. And then you also need to check if you need to register your hive. Some areas do, some areas you don't, and it's usually just as simple as filling out a form and saying, I have a beehive here. You just need to check with your local regulations to make sure you're allowed to have a beehive in your area. But I really encourage even urban or suburban people to look into it, because we have a big yard, but it's 50 yards away from our back deck. And aside from the occasional bee and my wife's flower boxes, they're not around. You don't see them. They're not causing a nuisance. They're not, causing any inconvenience, or they're not stinging people. And we have dogs, and they don't bother them. And so it's really something that is, there's a lot of fear over that I think is really unnecessary.
And after they've done their work, you've got a nice, fresh, local ingredient for your beers and for meads.
Yeah, exactly. And then not to mention the beeswax, too. That's, you can use it for candles, and people can make their own cosmetics, and, there's a big market for beeswax as well.
What are some resources that you use, either online, or are there magazines, or what are some sources of information that you go to?
To find more information, back when I was first interested in this about 3 or 4 years ago, my mother actually bought me a video set, and it was a progressive, a year in the life of a hive, and it showed all of the steps from installing your new package of hive to, how to maintain the hive, what things to do to look for, and unfortunately, even in this case, they talked about when to apply the proper medications and that kind of thing, and that was really helpful. And then I also have a really big book. It's probably about 3 inches thick, and it's called The Hive and the Honeybee. And that has all kinds of scientific information and data, about bees in particular. And then, of course, on the Internet, if you type in even the words backyard beekeeping, you'll find tons of information on mostly local people and pictures of their hives and their construction of them and what they do and how theirs is set up and how they manage it. And that's pretty much where I got my information from.
Is it kind of like the brewing community, where if people have information, they're likely to want to share it and put it out there?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. And even more so, because I kind of, like I said, I focus my efforts on our organic beekeeping, but even more so, I think, in the organic beekeeping. Everybody is, willing to share. And I'm a member of a couple of email groups where people will ask questions, and you can read, just like forums, beer forums, you can ask questions and people will answer you if they know, and you can read about other people's trials and tribulations and learn from their mistakes and things like that.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Well, Ryan, I appreciate your time, and I wish you luck with your beekeeping and your brewing, and may they peacefully coexist.
Thank you very much, James.
Well, thanks again to Ryan. Maybe when the kids get a bit older, I'll get into beekeeping. Sounds like a fascinating hobby, and one that I've been interested in for a while. Next week, we're arranging a tasting. Don't want to jinx it, but we're arranging a tasting of unusual brews with our buddy Michael Tonsmeyer up in our nation's capital. Mike has put together a collection of beers that have been fermented with things other than the standard brewer's yeast. So I can't wait for that. They're in the fridge, and it's real tempting not to pop the top ahead of time, but, got to be disciplined. So anyway, keep your fingers crossed on that one. We've got it scheduled to record before next week, so if all goes well, that will be next. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And while you're on our site, you can check out our online shop, where you can find great pricing on our DVDs and a combo deal to save you even more. In our first one, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, We walk you through the extract brewing process, step by step, from boiling to bottling. And in basic brewing, stepping into all grain, we take you through the all grain process, from milling your grain to collecting your wort. And we're working on DVD 3. More details later. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online. I'll pack it up myself. Also, remember our shirts and hats, including our ever-popular Go Forth and Flocculate shirt. And also, as usual, thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Art of Midway, Before Pixels and Polygons, and Mortgages for Dummies, second edition. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate the support. From that, we get a little bitty slice. Every little bit helps. Thanks, everybody. Until next week. Thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson down in Austin, who also did our logo. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.